Luce.
Do you want to hear my each poem? See your leech on a leech. Your leech on a leech on a beach. Eating a quiche that is a peach flavored one that is bleached. And you go to another beach with it and see me. And see another leech. But this time he's not on the leech. He's just sitting on a peach eating a quiche that is on the leech. Then you guys both go to a beach with him and see me. And you see another leech on a leech. That's you.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Portland City Council Chambers. We're very glad that you're here. We have a special presentation. I am very pleased as mayor to be able to read the following proclamation. That's right, proclamation. Whereas since 2001, Portland's Rock and Roll Camp for Girls has provided a space where girls learn leadership and teamwork skills and develop their self-esteem while learning music in a positive environment surrounded by female role models and mentors. And whereas Portland's Rock and Roll Camp for Girls has created such a successful model of workshops and technical training and mentoring that it has been turned into a rad template utilized by other cities around the world. And whereas Portland Rock and Roll Camp for Girls is not only giving rise to the next generation of political leaders, businesswomen, educators, self-actualized women, it is creating a space for women and girls to succeed in music on your own terms. And whereas Portland's Rock and Roll Camp for Girls has grown from one session a year to a full-year institution that includes classes for adult women and a recording studio, and whereas Portland's Rock and Roll Camp for Girls has seen a million faces and rock them all for a decade and is celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. Now, therefore, I, Sam Adams, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim June 29th, 2011, to be Portland's Rock and Roll Camp for Girls is an awesome day. Congratulations. Would you like to say something?
Thank you. Do you all have anything to say?
That was awesome.
I just want to say a couple words. I don't know quite how to top that. I'm Debbie Fox. I'm the executive director of the Rock Camp, and I just want to thank the city and the council members for supporting our mission of building young girls and women's self-esteem through music performance and creation. And we also have a special guest here, a Rock Camp graduate, Fabi Rania, who's going to perform a song for you all. She started at Rock Camp in 2005, and now you're 19, Fabi, and she plays around in bands around town and does a lot of touring and also runs a record label. So we're really excited to have her here.
And that's go ahead. Hit it.
How is it? Go for it.
Well, while you're getting ready, I have to tell you ladies that some people say that I got elected to the city council because I sang a Black Sabbath song at Candidates Gone Wild. So in addition to all the things that the mayor mentioned as potential careers, I hope you'll consider running for office someday.
And while you're setting up, Commissioner Fish has a long history, a founding history with the Rock and Roll Camp for Girls. I insist that you describe that.
Well, my daughter's a proud graduate. Yay! And I had the honor of being one of the first lawyers who helped set it up. And so congratulations to each of you. My daughter just got a scholarship to go to the college of her choice. And she found through music, sports, and her classroom work, she found her voice and her way, just like you will. So congratulations for making this commitment.
Well, I feel really honored to be here. I've been in Rock Camp for a really long time, and I can very confidently say that if it wasn't for Rock Camp, I'm not sure if I would be playing music this much or be running the record label that I'm running. I remember the first year that I went to Rock Camp, Kill Rock Stars and Sub Pop came, and I was like, that's so cool. That's like the coolest thing ever, you know, to run a label. Oh, thanks. So, I'm happy to give back. So, here I am. Mistakes, and I tried too hard, but man, it's got a hold of me. And I'm trying too hard to see all these people that mean nothing to me. And I look around, looking everywhere, but down to make sure that I'm safe up here. Oh, oh, oh. All these people that mean nothing to me. And I look around, looking everywhere but down to make sure that I'm safe. You flew across the sea, over the land, among the trees. I wonder why you never came.
That was amazing.
Thank you.
And where can people hear more of your music?
Well, I just put out a record, not just a year ago, on Talking Helps Records. So you can go to there. You can go to talkinghelpsrecords.com, and there'll be a list of people, and my name will be one of them.
Fantastic. Well, glad you're here. Happy birthday. Now, you're welcome to stay for the next 4 hours to see how democracy works locally, but you're also welcome to get up and go right now as well. We're really glad that you are here. Thank you. All right. Good morning, Carla. How are you?
I'm well. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you please call the roll?
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman? Leonard? Fritz?
Here.
Adams?
Here. We'll begin. A quorum is present. We will begin. Can you please read the communications item beginning with 654?
654, request of Patty Olson to address council regarding impact of post office station closures in Portland metro area.
Ms. Olson, please come forward. Oh, you come up one at a time. That's the way. The way we do things here, you just need to give us your first and last name, no address, no phone number. If you're speaking on behalf of an organization, you must declare that. We're glad you're here. And you'll have 3 minutes, and that clock in front of you will help you count it down.
Thank you. I'd just like to say at this time, Jamie Partridge would rather go first to keep, because we're all meeting. No?
That's the way it works. Sorry.
Okay. All right. No problem. Well, good morning. My name is Patty Olson, and I am the Director of Legislation for the American Postal Workers Union in Portland, Oregon here. I'm also a window clerk at the airport retail station, and I have been with the post office for 32 years. Right now, we're looking at a crisis within the Postal Service, and unfortunately, with service cutbacks, that has meant staffing cuts in many of the neighborhood post offices. Long lines, shorter hours have an impact not only on the employees, but the customers as well. Customers are unhappy, and the employees are frustrated. Where is the service that binds this nation together? There will be over 2,000 station closures approximately in the next few years, according to the Postal Service plan. The branch and neighborhood post offices anchor many businesses. Many customers expand their activities, such as shopping and business, within their same trip to the post office. This makes the business district a more attractive location for retailers and other businesses. The loss of longtime station can create a significant void in the local business community. The customer base is gone. Local neighborhood post offices that offer services within easy walking distance are also important, such as our own university station right down the street. College students, residents, and business depend on this station. For lower income residents, the use of money orders to pay rent and to pay their utilities and other bills is an important service in their day-to-day life, and they need the window service for their needs. They also need the post office boxes that they provide at their neighborhood post office. Unlike those that have internet access and a higher income where the businesses may be conducted online, these folks do not have that option for their mailing needs. When you look at households with the income less than $20,000, their options are limited. Approximately 35% of households with incomes less than $20,000 and 30% of households over the age of 65 do not have internet access. Those retirement centers and assisted living rely on the neighborhood post office as well. Recently, a small but vital downtown station, Solomon, was closed a few months ago. Cherry Blossom DCU on the east side was closed last year. Even though Cherry Blossom did not have a window service, the customers were able to pick up their packages and mail there. Now they are forced to drive many miles away to Park Rose and Lentz DCU to pick up their packages, and notice was not done in a timely manner. It would be wise for, the station, University Station right down the street may be next in 2013. This station is vital to the downtown businesses and offices. When will the customers and patrons have anything to say? It would be wise for the Postal Service to consider impacts of the station closures on the community. A public forum should be held in the impacted neighborhood for the community input. In my opinion, the profile of a station and branch closure targets communities with high percentages of low-income residents. Thank you.
Patty, can I just say one thing?
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you're here so I can say this today. I was at the main branch downtown next to the train station mm-hmm. recently, and your counterpart who I dealt with, I think her name was Mrs. Lee, L-I, I had to get my passport renewed.
Right, right.
And as you know, there's a mind-boggling set of paperwork you have to do.
Exactly.
And then you have to mail it and everything. Well, she walked me through every step, showed me where I had failed to fill out the right stuff, got the right postage on it, got it out. I got it back expedited a week earlier than had been promised by the State Department. So that's the kind of service I'm sure she gives everybody.
Yes.
But she also sold me a group of stamps that had the word love on them, which I gave to my daughter for her graduation. Anyway, thank you for your service and for the people like Mrs. Lee who make our lives a lot easier.
Yes. Yes, I know her very well, Donna Lee, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sue, can you please read the title for the next communications item?
655, request of Kevin Card to address council regarding future of postal delivery in Portland.
Hi, welcome.
Good morning.
Oops.
My name is Kevin Card. I'm a 25-year letter carrier, a Portland resident, and president of the Oregon State Association of Letter Carriers. This weekend, we're going to celebrate the 235th anniversary of the birth of this nation, and I'd like to tell you the Postal Service predates it by a year. In 1775, the Second Continental Congress appointed Benjamin Franklin, the very first postmaster of the United States, and 7 years later, George Washington said this of the fledgling Postal Service, "Let us bind these people together to us with the chain that can never be broken." And that's been our mission ever since. The spark of our revolution was delivered by a letter carrier named Paul Revere. Today, the Postal Service delivers to over 151 million homes, businesses, P.O. boxes across the nation. We have a retail network larger than Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart combined. Remarkably, most of our customers do not know this important fact, and that is that the Postal Service is a self-supporting company. Since 1982, the Postal Service has received no tax dollars. It is funded entirely by revenues. Well, we all know what's happened to the economy. Since the Great Recession took hold, the Postal Service has seen a huge drop in revenues. And to respond to that, they've taken a number of cost-cutting measures. We've saved over $9 billion over the last 2 years. But that's not enough, and it has to do with the fact that in 2006, the Congress passed a law forcing the Postal Service to make a yearly payment of $5.5 billion into a fund to pre-fund our retiree health care. No other company, public or private, in this country has to do that. It puts us at a competitive disadvantage. And when you hear in the future, which is going to happen, about the Postal Service losing massive amounts of money, that's a large part of it right there. On the flip side, there's good news here. The good news is that two independent studies have found that the Postal Service has put too much money into our retirement fund, $50 to $75 billion. What we're asking is the City Council and the citizens of Portland to understand these issues and to rally with us around our congressional members to make this accounting fix and to keep your local post office open, to allow us to continue to deliver mail 6 days a week, and to prevent places like University Station from being shut down. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Can you read the next communications title?
656, request of Jamie Partridge to address council regarding how the crisis within the U.S. Postal Service impacts Portland.
Welcome back, Mr. Partridge.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. And commissioners, I was supposed to be first. So these are the introductory remarks, which you didn't get. So I'm a 27-year letter carrier with the U.S. Postal Service, and I'm here along with two other carriers and a postal clerk to talk about this crisis and how it affects residents, businesses, mailers, workers in Portland, and to ask for your help. Irregular, late, after dark delivery. Long lines at the post offices. Post office closures, threatened closures. We are severely understaffed. There's been a hiring freeze, career hiring freeze for the last 3+ years, so that people retire, they're not replaced. In my post office, which is Martin Luther King Jr. Post Office in Inner Northeast Portland, we have 25 routes. 5 of them are vacant. That means there's no regular letter carrier on that route. It means I deliver my route, and then I go and deliver an hour or two on a vacant route before my route, after my route. I don't know the people who live, you know, I don't know the people at the residences. I don't know who used to live there. I don't know who has a dog, what kind of hazards there are. I don't know where the mailbox is. I don't know where to put the parcel on the front porch or the back porch. I don't know if there's a frail or elderly person in there that needs to have their door knocked. So customer service has been deteriorating in the last few years. Working standards, working conditions are deteriorating. And the Postmaster General says that he wants to cut more labor costs due to this financial crisis. He wants to eliminate Saturday delivery. He wants to close thousands, maybe tens of thousands of post offices. What you're looking at there is first of all, we've gone to neighborhood associations, community groups, getting petitions signed, letters of concern. We're trying to change management's practices. We're trying to get the Congress or the president to fix the accounting problem. It could take an executive order by the president. What you're looking at here is a report by the Portland Area Workers' Rights Board, a project of Jobs with Justice, which held a hearing a few months ago, attended by over 100 people, with testimony by 20 customers, mailers, business people, residents, postal workers about this crisis, and a panel made up of elected officials, clergy, academic, consumer advocate, recommended an end to the hiring freeze, restoration of customer service, saving 6-day delivery and the community post offices, and calling on Congress to make a quick fix of this accounting problem. And we're going to be coming to each of you in the next few weeks to ask for either a resolution or a letter of concern to help us build public support and have Congress and the President do the right thing. Thank you very much.
Thanks. We'll be happy to work with you on that letter. And then can you read the final communications item?
Item 657, request of Willie Groeschel to address Council regarding ways to increase the positive impact the U.S. Postal Service could have within the local community.
Welcome. Glad you're here.
Good morning. Thank you all very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
My name is Willie Groeschel. I've been a letter carrier for nearly 6 years now. I live up in beautiful Northeast Portland. I get the fun task of presenting you with the strengths that the Postal Service has and ways to expand on those so we can stay viable and be a great asset to the communities as we move into the future. The Postal Service has got three unique strengths. We have the last mile delivery network. We're the only organization that goes to every single doorstep, every single house in this entire country. There's no network that even comes close to touching that. We also have a local government building in every community, big and small, that can be used better to provide more services and government services to the people. We also have the largest fleet of vehicles in the entire country that could be used for better uses. I'm just going to give you a few ideas because I only got 3 minutes. Last mile network. We could provide pickup and delivery of wine and beer, which would help local businesses quite a bit, just using age verification delivery services, which already exist. We could check in on elderly and disabled loved ones that live at home on a daily basis and send a quick electronic message either to your email or your cell phone, letting you know how they're doing, enabling people to stay home safely longer, living an independent lifestyle at home. We could act as an age identification service for internet providers, whether it be ISP providers or internet companies. We could go to the doorsteps of the households that we already know and verify that such and such person that wants to sign up for thing is the correct age or has the correct necessary means to be allowed onto that service. We could provide postage on the spot. People could come up to us. We could use our scanners to scan to take payment for postage and print out postage on the spot. We could do a lot of things. We could also provide emergency preparedness advice. We could contact the neighborhoods because we have people in every neighborhood. We know which houses, which areas are most at threat. We could make sure that those people, in case of a disaster, have the opportunity to get directed where they need to be to get the resources and help they need. Take our postal buildings. We have also one of the largest computer networks in the entire country. We could have kiosks that provide internet access to people that can't afford it on their own. We could provide electronic banking. We could become the public's access to digital banking no matter where you are within this country. We could also provide government licensing, parks, park passes, forms, information. Just make government more accessible in communities big and small. And our fleet of vehicles, if we modernize that and make it into a green fleet using electric, modern technology, we could not only reduce pollution, but reduce our fuel costs dramatically. And we could also equip the vehicles with air sensors that would pick up on weather pattern changes, possible biological threats, or even pollen issues that could provide real-time updates. There's a lot of things that we could do. We just need to use them better. And that's what we here as a dedicated workforce want to see happen and want to provide to the public. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Those are great ideas. And we really appreciate you all coming here and look forward to working with you on that communications, that letter.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
All right. We'll now consider the consent agenda. Does anyone wish to pull any items from the consent agenda?
Mayor, I'd like to pull items 6, 7, 3, and refer it back to my office.
Item 6, 7, 3. Can you please read that title?
673. Authorize intergovernmental agreement with Multnomah County Drainage District regarding work at Whitaker Ponds Natural Area.
Unless there are objections, 673 is referred back to the office of Commissioner Nick Fish. Any other items? All right, can you please call the vote on the consent agenda?
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Prince?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Referred. No, consent agenda is approved. Can you move, that moves us to the regular agenda. Can you please read the title for non-emergency ordinance item number 677?
Amend the business license law to create non-refundable youth employment tax credit program dedicated to eligible local businesses that support career-related learning experiences in city schools and a non-refundable tax program to employ foster youth.
Thank you. This city council has been very supportive of the Cradle to Career initiative that is underway through the Schools Foundation, and we've had reports on that before. It is intended to improve academic performance of our students, to improve the life success of area youth. We have and do fund. We doubled our funding for summer school. We offer internships, paid summer internships here in the city and the county. We help fund career and college visitation trips in the summer. These are all part of the efforts of Cradle to Career to bring meaningful and effective community support to Portland's youth and our schools, and to ensure that they have the skills and the education necessary to compete in what is a tough economy now, but even in the best of times, is very tough. Today is a moving forward on a pilot project on a tax credit for businesses. Harvard University's Pathway to Prosperity points out for the need to expand employment and work access learning opportunities for young people, closer ties between post-secondary education training and the workplace, and expanded youth apprenticeships. The pilot in front of us today can create up to 100 jobs for youth, and in the process address the fact that this is the highest youth unemployment rate, I think, for the third summer running in the entire time that we have been recording youth employment and unemployment data. This is a $500 non-refundable credit. It is related to the city's business license tax. It has been devised in consultation with providers of best practices around the United States and local community providers. Businesses need to be able to provide a career-related service that falls into one of three categories. One is career preparation activities, which are basically internships and apprenticeships for youth who are 16 and older. Another is career exploration activities for some of our younger youth that would include job shadowing, interviewing, business-led service learning projects that benefit the community. The number of credits will be capped at 4 for each business that choose to engage in these activities in order for them to be eligible for the tax credit. The number of credits, or the credits will be available in this pilot for 2011-2012. We are hopeful that we will see the results based on our initial survey of businesses, and we will learn and perfect as we go. The fiscal impact is capped at $50,000 per tax year. That's an initial introduction. Terry, do you want to?
Terry Williams, License and Tax Division Manager for the Revenue Bureau. I can talk about the technical aspects of the credit and how that works. What we did to design this is to add three code sections to the business license law. The first one defines definitions for these two credits, actually, that are in this ordinance and any future ones that might come along to give some parameters and some common definitions that seem to be there all of the time. The second section is specifically a credit for foster youth employment, which is something that Commissioner Saltzman has been very interested and proactive about, and that credit is laid out. That's also only for the 2 years, and it is a total of 25 credits with some of the same parameters as the other one. And then finally is the third credit that the mayor spoke about, the youth career readiness credit. For businesses that provide those activities. So if that's kind of how it's laid out for those 2 years, the fiscal impact actually for for the two tax years covers three of the city's fiscal years to lessen it for each one. And if there are any questions about the technical aspects, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Any questions? Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think we're excited about this opportunity. We know that in order for our youth to graduate from high school on time and enter a career, they need these experiences. We know the districts want it. We know that the programs working with businesses say it's something that they're seeing the most at-risk youth being able to make it because they have the experiences. So we're excited about the opportunity to get more businesses on board for it.
Okay. Is anyone signed up to testify?
No one else signed up.
Okay. Are there any, unless there's additional council discussion, this moves to a second reading next week. So done. Thank you. If it's okay with council, given that we have a number of volunteers in the audience, I'd like to deal with emergency ordinance-related items. There's no vote today on any of these, so we'll allow that testimony to happen in there, Matt.
Before people.
So can you read all of them together?
The 681 through 685?
Yep.
Okay. 681.
Okay. So you're reading non-emergency ordinances?
We're going to read all these together, and they basically all hang together. 681 through the resolutions. We're not voting on any of the resolutions or anything today, but just hearing them out. We will take amendments next week, and then we will vote and hopefully vote in an emergency ordinance basis on the 13th. So we have 3 weeks of processing, but then we'll be able to do them immediately. I do want to say at the outset that as of the moment, this moment, if there is an emergency between now and when we vote on these, we expect our legislative intent is we will work with, we will operate under these ordinances and resolutions. But I want to give plenty of time to air out details and to get input.
681.
I'm out on city business next Wednesday, so I wouldn't be here to offer amendments then.
I'd be happy to introduce them on your behalf. And then you'll have the opportunity to tweak them as well on the 13th, because we'll do it by emergency then. Okay. So you'll have three bites at the apple.
681, amend code to improve coordination of the city emergency management system. 682, adopt revision to the basic emergency operations plan. 683, adopt 2011 alert and warning annex. 684, adopt the 2011 flood response appendix. And 685, adopt the 2011 terrorism appendix.
So by way of introduction, it was 3.5 years ago, before I was mayor, that director of the Portland Office of Emergency Management, who we will hear from in a minute, Carmen Merlot, asked the auditor to complete an audit of the operations of the Office of Emergency Management, but also the general system within the city for preparing for and responding to emergencies. It is rare that a bureau director ask for an audit themselves, so I want to commend you for that. That happened before I was in charge, but the audit was completed about a year and a half ago, or released about a year ago. And gave us some very good feedback on ways that we can improve upon what we have on the books by way of preparation and response. And so council calendar items 681 through 685 are in response to that audit and also represent a scan of best practices nationally on other issues. So I'm very pleased to move this forward. This builds on the work that the council has moved forward in terms of the west side, going after the west side emergency management. Sorry, the west side, proposed west side emergency operations and center at the Jerome Sears site. And it also moves forward. I'm sorry, it also is on top of the work that we did through Commissioner Leonard's efforts through the Bureau of Water, where we now have an ability for citizens to sign up for and register their cell phone number so that in an emergency we can get a hold of them. So Carmen Merlot.
Thank you, Mayor, and good morning, Commissioners. As the Mayor said, in May of 2010, the City Auditor's Office completed their audit of the City's Emergency Management Program, and part of that audit included 7 recommendations, and I'd made a commitment to the Mayor that I would implement all of those recommendations, so I'm very pleased to be here today to present to you several key documents that shows POM's progress in both enhancing the emergency management program for the city as well as in implementing the audit recommendations. These documents are just a sample of the emergency plans and initiatives that will come before you both later this year and in the years to come as we work towards enhancing the city's overall capabilities to mitigate, prevent, respond, and recover from any emergency. So the first of these recommendations has to do with changes to City Code Titles 3 and 15. These code changes help to better document the roles and responsibilities of both POM and its advisory committees and helps clarify the governance structure for the entire emergency management program. So some of the key changes that were made to City Code include tightening up language that better clarifies POM's role as the coordinating agency for emergency management, eliminating one of POM's 3 advisory committees, the Emergency Management Committee, adding the directors of the Bureau of Environmental Services and Human Resources to the membership of the Disaster Policy Council, documenting the methods for decision-making and record-keeping for the remaining advisory committees, and finally, adding specific provisions that formalizes the Neighborhood Emergency Team Program and providing indemnification for Neighborhood Emergency Team volunteers while acting under the direction of the POM director and within the scope of training. And I want to take a moment, if I could, to acknowledge our Neighborhood Emergency Team volunteers that are in the chamber today as well as in the communities at large. Our NET members know that emergency preparedness is a shared responsibility, and I want to thank them deeply for the efforts they've taken to both prepare themselves and to assist their neighbors responding to and recovering from emergencies. The next few council agenda items ask for your adoption of several new and updated emergency plans. The first of these is the basic emergency operations plans. This is the core emergency plan for the city that outlines the key roles and responsibilities for all bureaus and talks about how the city will respond to any emergency. The next is a plan, a new plan is the Alert and Warning Annex. This describes the use of various technologies to alert the public and government officials of an emergency situation. More specifically, it defines the triggering events that requires a notification to POM and the approved mechanisms, whether it be the emergency alert system, the first call notification system, social media, traditional media, how it is that we use to notify the public of emergency events. Next is an update of the flood response annex, which acknowledges the Portland Bureau of Transportation as the lead response bureau for all flood situations and assigns roles and responsibilities to other key bureaus to coordinate flood fighting activities across the city limits. And the last item on the agenda is to adopt an updated terrorism plan, which acknowledges the Portland Police Bureau as the lead response bureau for terrorist events. It further clarifies the roles and responsibilities of both county, state, and federal agencies in coordinating responses to a terrorist event. I want to note that these are not tactical plans. These are concepts of operation, general frameworks of how the city will respond to emergencies. Each bureau that's been assigned a lead response bureau status has the ultimate responsibility of providing the more detailed, specific plans, protocols, guidelines that help to define their operational tactical roles. These plans are also living documents. They are updated after exercises, after trainings, and after real-world events, as well as on a regular cycle. And we will continue to refine them throughout the year and the upcoming years. These plans have all been reviewed by our Emergency Management Steering Committee, the Disaster Policy Council, our regional partners, and we've done targeted and general outreach to the public as well. Finally, I want to really thank my staff, who I know I've driven crazy over this last year. I have one of the smallest bureaus in the city, but I have some of the most committed staff who are true champions of the work we do, so I want to thank them for their work in helping me honor my commitment to the mayor.
Initial questions. Commissioner Fritz?
I have a lot, but maybe after the
the testimony presentations.
Okay. Let's move to testimony then.
If four people who signed up, first three, please come on up. Are Chris Both, is it? Sorry. Betsy Shand and Joshua Patterson.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners. My name is Chris Bowe. I'm currently the Vice Chair for the Portland Neighborhood Emergency Team, more commonly known as NET. And I'm also the NET representative for the Northeast Neighbor Association. Excuse me, not the Northeast Neighbors, the Coalition, representing NET members. And I'm just also I'm a member of the Beaumont Wilshire NET team, and I'm a ham operator. In my capacity as the vice chair, I wanted to at least make one short comment, and then leave it to my peers to make their comment. There are over 1,200 trained volunteers in our city who are being underutilized, and many of them have been lost to other activities because of the indemnity issue. If the indemnity change passes, it would free the Portland Office of Emergency Management to call out these neighborhood emergency team members or NET, these volunteers, who would call them up to help as needed. Imagine the result if 1,200 trained volunteers showed up to help at a disaster site in our city. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Commissioners. And today I wanted to be here as a representative of my neighborhood, South Burlingame. I'm the chairperson of that neighborhood for the last 5 years and a member of the Sweeney Southwest Neighborhoods Coalition office, and also work as a part of the Public Safety Committee there. There's an obvious need, and there's a real urgency on the part of the citizenry to get involved now. They want to become involved. We need some new avenues, and I hope that we can address those with Ms. Merlot at POM on how people can get trained now. We have people who've been trained in the past. Those people seem to have fallen away. We're at a unique point in time. We see disasters of biblical proportions going on all around us. Let's get ready just in case there's one here. There are people available. There are people that are trained. We're some of them. We all sit on the NET Steering Committee Board, and we're willing to do a lot more. So with your help, that would move us forward. And thank you very much for your vote on the Sears building.
Good morning. My name is Joshua Patterson. I am a member of Portland NET teams. I'm a team leader for the Montevilla Hood neighborhood, and also assist with the steering committee. My idea to be here today is to bring forth the power that the 1,200 trained individuals can bring to our city in the event of any type of emergency, which there are a variety of. The indemnification clause will allow people who are formally trained to operate under the guise of POEM to help our citizens not only train themselves and educate themselves, but to help save lives in an emergency, to manage triage areas, and to really be there when we're needed to alleviate the pressures of the Portland Fire and Rescue, the Portland Police Department, and other emergency manager operators. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, and thank you for your service. We really appreciate it.
The last person is Jeffrey M. Cohen.
And Ellen, could you come up to talk after on the indemnification issue? Hi, welcome. Glad you're here.
Thank you very much. I just have really one brief statement to make. In the last major earthquake in California, approximately 80% of all emergency response was performed by the community emergency response teams, by CERTs. Here in Portland, we would be also called CERTs, except that our SWAT team is called CERT with an S instead of a C. But that's the main point I want to make here. In an emergency, it's people like us, our citizens, who are going to be able to help one another. And we need the indemnification bill to be passed so that we can do our job. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for your service. Carmen, can you come back up? So can you talk why, why it's taken so long over the years? This predates all of us. And what's different now that we're able to do the indemnification, and what is it?
Sure. Ellen Osinek, a deputy city attorney, and members of council, Mayor, the changes around indemnification are really just designed to give reassurances to our volunteers that when they're responding to an emergency at our request, that they are indemnified to the extent that they would be under state law. So there's emergency volunteer provisions under state law that say that you're indemnified if you are working as an emergency volunteer. And so we wanted to enshrine in code that, in fact, that's what we consider net volunteers to be. And so we recognize our duty to defend and indemnify them when they're responding to an emergency. And best practices nationwide are that you include training for emergencies in your defense and indemnification clauses. And state law does that, and we did that as well. And your first question, which is, you know, why has this taken so long? I think that the over probably the last, you know, 10 to 20 years, the law around defending and indemnifying volunteers is complicated and has been changing. And even FEMA has been over the last probably 5 to 10 years putting out new guidelines and helping to shape best practices. It's still an area where clarification is badly needed, but I definitely think for our purposes, we are following nationwide best practices and certainly the practices of the state.
And in order to get those credentials, as a NET team, certified NET team member, folks go through significant training, and in order to maintain them, have to remain active and on top of things. So I am absolutely comfortable with this change, and I think it will unlock a lot more involvement because you'll actually be able to do what we're training you to do without fear of being sued personally, which I understand no one would want to take on. So additional conversation, Commissioner Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor. And just in following up from that, it's similar to what neighborhood associations and other groups sanctioned by the city already have due to the federal law. And so that I want to make sure that there are Good Samaritan laws and others that do protect people. This putting the NET teams in the code and having a structure for that defines who is covered by that level of indemnification. And so I think this is a good move. Carmen, I appreciate you giving me yesterday the track changes on the ordinance, on the code changes. I noticed that you deleted the definition of disaster and changed the purpose of POEM. And the purpose of POEM now is to centralize leadership and coordination of emergency management. And emergency management means an approach to prevent, protect, respond to, recover from, and mitigate the effects of incidents regardless of cause, size, location, or complexity. So doesn't that change what we're talking about an emergency? It could be a very minor thing. And are you intending for POEM to be more involved with police and fire daily work?
Commissioner Fritz, no. To your first question about removing the word disaster, when we declare an emergency. And so we took out all references to the word disaster from city code as well as all of our documents. We acknowledge that there is really no main role for POEM if a lead bureau or even two bureaus normally deal with emergencies on a day-to-day basis. So fire bureau putting out fires, police bureau doing their operations. There's no role for POEM there. Where there is a role for POEM is when a response requires the very close coordination of two or more bureaus. And that's really never changed. We didn't change the purpose of POEM. We better clarified what our roles and responsibilities are. It was really a lot of it's very amorphous, ambiguous language in there. We hope to tighten up that language based on some of the recommendations from the audit.
Thank you. I'll be interested in working with the mayor over the next week to see if we could get some amended language. So as a further clarification, the Disaster Policy Council definition has also been changed. and now it's for promoting inter-bureau cooperation and defining emergency management program goals and priorities. Why is it no longer a policy council, and what's the role of the council, the city council, in defining policies and working with the policy council?
So one of the main changes for the Disaster Policy Council was that there was no role for them during peacetime. They were mostly an agency that came together only after an emergency was declared. So this better clarifies their role in peacetime operations as well as during emergency events. POM was given a lot of responsibility but no authority to do a lot of this coordinating work. This helps through the Disaster Policy Council acting through the mayor, gives all the members of the DPC the ability to influence their bureaus in coordinating emergencies response.
But isn't that POEM? I'm not clear about what the role of POEM is in that and in holding bureaus accountable versus the policy council.
Well, we are the coordinating bureau, so we help to coordinate the work of all the other bureaus. We rely on the bureau directors as part of the Disaster Policy Council to help us achieve those goals by securing their commitments for their personnel, their resources, et cetera.
So, again, I'd be happy to work with the mayor on the accountability piece. Why are we removing the penalty for any person who violates any emergency measure shall be subject to a civil penalty?
I can actually answer that, Mr. Fritz. Even though we had that in code, it's actually not enforceable. And I can explain maybe a little bit more why that is afterwards. But the way that we had provided for enforcement, it actually should be enforceable under state criminal code rather than the city code. So it was both. We couldn't actually enforce the way it was written, and then it was a sort of redundancy under criminal law. So because you can, if you fail to obey a lawful order by any peace officer, it's a misdemeanor.
Okay, thank you. And then I guess my final question is the relationship between the POEM director and the rest of the council as well as the mayor. It seems like the city council has been removed from some of the lines of responsibility and the policy setting, and I wondered if that was intentional.
Not at all. So, Commissioner Fentz, can you tell me specifically what you're...
I'd be happy to work with you over the next 2 weeks or next week to do that. There's a number of other slight technical things. And overall, I would really like to see more involvement by the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, the Office of Human Relations, and the mayor convened a meeting yesterday, which I'm really grateful for, which he's, of course, set forward in the budget process to provide more collaboration between police, fire, ONI, human relations, and POEM. I think that's commendable, and I'm very happy that we're working on that. So I'll look forward. I think there's some amendments in this that could further reflect that.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Carmen, I won't be here next week, and the week after I'll be doing site visits and emergency preparedness in Barcelona, Madrid, and Cordova.
I'll be there later this summer as well.
But I do think it's worth noting that in the 3 years that I've been on the council, I think that we've had at least two, maybe three exercises where you've walked us through significant disasters. I think the last one was a 6-point-something earthquake, bridges down, you know, huge loss of life, calamity. What has impressed me is not just the amount of planning that you do on a regular basis for those events, but the way you engage the council, the decision-making process, the way we end up making decisions. I actually, for a moment, was making decisions until the mayor showed up and declared something like martial law, what he can do under the statute. But my point is that having participated in those exercises, I think it's important for the public to know that we already have well-developed plans in place for significant disasters. And what we're doing is enhancing and fine-tuning and updating. But we currently have tremendous plans and a very coordinated communication tree. And it's for me, it's been a pleasure to learn about how those systems work and what our role is. And I think you do a terrific job.
Thank you, Commissioner.
All right. Unless there is further discussion, this moves to another hearing. On the regular agenda next week. We will not be voting next week, but it'll be an opportunity to
take more public testimony. We'll be emailing these out, links to these out to the public and to other partners for their inputs. We might have amendments next week, and then we can also make amendments the following week. We'll also be sending out a notice to bureau managers that between now and the vote in 3 weeks that we are operating under these to be approved where we can legally, these to be improved upon protocols. All right. Can you please read the title for emergency ordinance item number 678?
678, authorize emergency contract with Tri-State Construction, Inc., for landslide mitigation on Southwest Sam Jackson Park Road.
Well, we have a serious issue in the city, a major road that connects a good part of traffic that allows for traffic to access OHSU. Sam Jackson Road is sliding off the hill. And we need to make some improvements. We need to make them quickly. They're going to be expensive, and they're going to be difficult to complete. And we've got to do it during a construction season that has already started. So we're working hard to get on top of this, and today we're going to this is an emergency ordinance to allow for an emergency contract with Tri-State Construction for said landslide mitigation.
Thank you, Mayor Adams. City Commissioners, my name is Dave Ramungi. I'm the City of Portland Transportation Bridge Engineer, but also landslides. And I'm here to talk to you today about this emergency ordinance. It is on Sam Jackson Road, and I do have a PowerPoint that seems to have difficulty in loading,
which will
briefly take you through it.
Have faith, my friend. Have faith.
I will.
Carla is a miracle worker. She's making this old 1990s equipment sink. There we go. All right.
Okay. Oh, thank you. We do hope to get this landslide mitigation work done in the summer during the dry season. It's always good to avoid rain when you're dealing with landslides. And this is a situation where the city is actually being proactive to avoid a much bigger disaster by solving the problem before it actually occurs. The location is on Sam Jackson Park Road, which is actually the designated primary access route to the Markham Hill medical facilities. A lot of people use Campus Drive, but that is not the designated route Sam Jackson is. And as you climb Sam Jackson, as you meander up, just before the final turn that takes you to Shriners, there is a long stretch of road that is actually fill that was placed in the 1920s when they built the Multnomah Hospital. And the fill is slowly failing over time. We have been monitoring a crack in the road there for the past 6 years. At first, the crack was insignificant, but it grew in time. And you can see the limits of that crack here as it transcends longitudinally to the road. This is a photograph from 2006 where we have a crack sealant in the road. It's barely noticeable, although maybe if you're up close you would. But 5 years later, you can see there is significant movement occurring in the roadway, in the fill material. Our geotechnical engineer has looked at it, and we've concurred that there is a slip failure slowly occurring, and if we permitted it to occur, it would completely take out the road, and there would be no primary access to the Markham Hill facilities. In the winter of 2010, we installed a piezometer in the roadway, which is a long vertical shaft, to look at the movement in the depth of the soil that you can't see by observation. And we took readings in November, December, February, and April. And I've color-coded them for you here. You can see for November and December, the movement was barely noticeable. But once the rain began in February and April, there was a massive significant amount of movement. We actually had more movement occur in that rainy season in March and April than we had in the previous 5 years, which led us to think that we need to act now to solve the problem instead of waiting for the slide to occur. So we have met extensively with the Markham Hill facility people, and we have come up with a traffic detour plan with their input. This is more now about managing traffic as opposed to doing the site works. site works is quite easy compared to the traffic management plan. We hope to begin construction on July 11th and have it done by Labor Day. One is to get it done in the dry season, but secondly is because once Labor Day ends, there's a significant increase in